Mr. Chadwick, Rail 6. We're talking about your time with the 16th Battalion, 7th Platoon C Company. And you probably joined them round about very late September or early October, because it was after the Germano battles, but before they went to, obviously, Greece. You mentioned that the first time you moved up, you don't remember the names of the places, that's fair enough, but what was the situation that first time when you moved into the line, as far as you recall it? You know, what sort of positions had you taken up?
Well, like, there were two positions, which they always were, and of course if you needed a company attack, you pulled all the platoons together and did the necessary. And it was primarily patrol work. As I say, that's where I first decided I wanted to move, get some rank. Not the financial embellishment didn't come in them days, but my first feeling was, and I don't want to sound big-headed for want of a word, I thought I'd feel safer if I'm in charge of this lot than somebody else leading me.
Was there any particular incident made you think that?
Well, you know, the patrol commander, it might be a Lance Corporal or a Corporal, would brief you and say, well, we'll see what it's like, lads. And if it's a bit dodgy, we're going to pull back a bit, or on about blow this. It's not terribly cut and dry. Again, with hindsight, I can understand them. The war's not going to go on forever. They weren't going to stick their necks out and get killed in what maybe they thought was a bit unwarranted, especially for fighting the troops, because the chances were, if you got caught, you wouldn't come back, because you were outnumbered by atrocious numbers. Again, secondly, a lot of these fellows were getting battle-weary, for want of a word, especially after Germano, which knocked them all for six. So there, outlook on it was different than mine. Mine was excitement and wanting to get involved. Where they've gone through that period, and they always say the first time in is the best, because you don't know what's coming. And every time you go back after, it gets a little bit worse, because you realise what you're going into.
So You had a platoon position. What would a platoon position be like? Could you describe it? I know it's...
Well, take a heavy picture, and a platoon, like everything else, is broken down into three. You have three sections and a headquarters. And, of course, you take up position with a fire card to cover the whole area, as it were.
Can you just explain that for them, a fire card?
Well, a fire card... you get onto a hill and the enemy's obviously at the other side. So to cover your front, you have to look at the two flanks in the centre to stop anybody attacking the position. Of course, the platoon commander sets out the section positions, and then the section commander does likewise with his section. He gives them a fire card from, we cover from here to there. So the whole front's covered with defensive fire in the event of an attack. That's basically.
So a fire card was the division of what's in front of you into sections.
In so much as on paper, it's more in the mind. But
so you'd cover from that tree to that tree, or
back from that tree to that tree. I've just got an example of one for that, or from that creature to that wooded area there. The centre patrol section there and the right flank, and then the next platoon would take over a bit further on.
Now, how would you dig in? What sort of slit trench or whatever would you dig?
Depending, if the position was going to be permanent, and you thought it was going to be permanent, you'd dig a bit of scrape, something you could lie in. If it was only going to be temporary, you might not dig in until decisions were made. you may be on the reverse slope, because at night time you have your forward position by day, and then at night time, as it were, you just have your lookouts forward in your slits. The remainder on the reverse slope, which means they can have some rest, get a little bit of sleep, a little relax, maybe take the boots off if it's not too critical, and get that little respite that they need. Because to stay up there all the time, your nerves are getting edgy, especially at night time. If there's a wind blowing and there's leaves and bits of tree branches cracking, you get the heebie-jeebies. So it is a test of your nerves. And I don't think we're not all built the same. And by that I mean, we're not talking about bravery and in the first nature. Some cope far better than others on gross conditions. Unfortunately, I came in the good category. I wasn't terribly frightened at any time. I was wary, where some lads just couldn't take it. And a good corporal in my group, who got a good sergeant, would know these lads. And when they come out the line, either try and get them, the medical officers to talk to them, or LOB them.
Which means?
Leave them out of battle. Let out of battle. But numbers were so thin on the ground, it was so hard to do that. And it takes the lads back in the were sometimes a liability. They were that frightened from the offset. Hundreds weren't. I wasn't an exception, there was hundreds like me. But there was quite a number at the opposite time.
How would they show their nerves?
Sheer fright, freezing. You know, if you said move, they couldn't move, some of them. Just sit there, or run the other way, and lie down somewhere. You know, I know in the First World War people were shot for this, but it was ridiculous, because they just couldn't cope. The physical attitudes didn't allow them to cope with the situation.
So there was no, I mean, it wasn't a matter of court martials if they're caught running away or anything like that. You just dealt with it in-house.
As much as you could, and sensibly. Try and find them a job as a dining room or in the back at Italian headquarters, or give them some mundane job working with the ammunition men, or help the coast guards with the food and supplies.
Were they looked down on?
Not really, because everybody understood it. I think a lot felt like doing at times, but people like to call it moral fibre or character. Some of these lads who were terribly frightened were smashing lads, but it was just in them. They just couldn't cope with the situation. It was too much for them. That's purely my view. And it's true, they were, when we come out the line, you hear lads saying, I just can't cope with this. Any way I could get out of going back up there, I would. But of course they couldn't.
Now, so what would the routine be when you were in a position like that? Platoon position.
The routine in all active service, every morning at first light, is usually half an hour before daylight, you stand to. Everybody stands to. When you stand to, then you take your toll of the night's work, i.e. missing, wounded, or dead, KIA. Then you take your ammunition returns. How people are standing with ammunition. That information then is fed straight back to the battalion headquarters. and of course, for obvious reasons, with ammunition. By that return, you know how much to get up to you to keep you up to strength with ammunition. The others is purely administrative, i.e., for the missing wounded or whatever that happened during the night. And then, same routine daily, watching and depending what the other fellow's doing.
Would you have a sentry rotor for in your pits, you know?
Oh, yeah. So, the object of the exercise is to get as much rest as you can when you can. And it's silly for everybody to be on the lookout when one man could do it all and give the alarm. Giving the other fellows a chance for respite.
So, the sentry, how would they look? Would they look over the, well, the top, but would they look from the, over the front?
The crest of the hill, looking forward, what you might call as an observation post, observing everything that went on and feeding back. You'd have a couple of riflemen and a wireless man. So, the lads on the first slope, they would get a breather, if it was possible, could be alerted at seconds as it were.
So, the rest of you would be trying to get a bit of kip.
Bit of kip, bit of relaxing, smoke, a brew, if it was possible.
Did people smoke more, do you reckon?
Of course, at times, cigarettes were more acceptable than food. For instance, if it was very bad, heavy shelling or whatever. It was heavy shelling everywhere, anything of that nature, and food couldn't be got. It was far easier to get 5,000 cigarettes up to a section than hay boxes and dragging food up under adverse conditions. And of course, the smoking took the hunger pangs away, so it did help. Hence, this is where I started smoking properly. Because everybody smokes. And there's no doubt about it, it is a relaxer, especially if you're a bit tense. But the cigarettes did help, and there's no doubt about that in my mind, even to this day. I think because we're late digressing slightly, the medical pamphlets we got for shock was keep the patient warm and comfortable as possible. If possible, a cup of hot sweet tea and a cigarette. And that was a medical theory of them days. I don't think much to add to that. I mean, the circumstances, especially with Italy being a mountainous area, the Gothic line, which was mountainous, it put great pressure on the administrative people, the Colours Arms, the quartermaster, for getting food and rations to you and ammunition.
How would they get them up? How did food?
Jeeps. Go as far as they could with vehicles. But at night time, you'd have track discipline and light discipline. And it made it treacherous. I mean, you couldn't go up there with lights blazing. And of course, the roads weren't A1s or anything, or M62s. They were cart tracks, whatever. And it was a hazardous job. And then you would have orderlies, reps from each company and each platoon at the jeep head to carry the food or whatever rations or whatever were being brought up. Then carry them on foot to their own position.
And how? What form would it come in? I mean, were they on compo, the compo system?
Well, it was compo, but many times the old hay box, if you were fortunate, had a good messing of what would you call it, scouse or...
Stew.
Stew, all in stew. Bobby beef, anything thrown in.
Would it still be hot?
All the hay boxes were very, very good. But again, Mules were used quite a bit. And of course, the old mules, if they decided not to move, they wouldn't move. And you could prick them and prod them and do what you liked. And the delay meant it was cooler, but it was always welcome. But tinfoil was a great asset.
Now, did you get it as boxes of composition rations? You know, the composition rations. Did you get it like that, or would it be broken up?
No, you'd get it and you'd break it up.
And what would there be? What was there in a box?
Well,
roughly.
I'll tell you, one of the main things, we used to have bars of chocolate about 5 inches long and about an inch thick. And the beauty of that were, you could either suck it as a bar of chocolate, and it was sustaining, but you could also make a chocolate drink. If you could borrow some water and put a lump of chocolate in, stir it up, it was a bit of a luxury. It does bring to mind something that, of course, you used to get a lot of biscuits and hardtack, probably had biscuits, of course. And the tins that the biscuits were in showed a girl diving off a diving board. And it had on the top, Breezy Blackpool. And it's true, this, you may laugh. The powers that be decided it was bad for morale to have this girl in a swimming costume enjoying herself at Breezy Blackpool. So they had the labels all removed before the biscuits came up. But there again, the biscuits, tasteless, horrible, but there was some body in them.
Were these like dog biscuits?
They were dog biscuits, practically. Just like plain dog biscuits.
How big?
Well, they were about 2 inches square, I would say. An eighth of an inch thick. But tasteless. But apparently there was wheat and all kinds. But they were better than nothing, let's put it that way.
What about the tin food? How did you get bored of it?
Well, you did. But the thing I found with the tin food was everybody used to refuse it, was the treacle cake or something it was called. It wasn't very appetizing, but what it did, I was a growing lad then, I was about 12 stone then days. It failed you. It wasn't tasty, but you felt you'd had a meal if you got a tin of that going, which was something.
Well, did you get water or did you get it as tea?
Oh, you got water. You see, all these administrative problems depend on the situation. If the situation's really bad and there's a lot of fighting going on, it's catch-as-catch-can. You get what you can when you can. If it's pretty clear and the front is reasonably quiet, like they used to say, only patrol activity going on, then you'd have a fair chance of getting quite a decent ration of food for you. Invariably, it was sufficient. It wasn't luxurious, but it was sufficient to keep you going.
Would you have enough water about to keep yourself clean, washing in the front line?
Well, it's essential, and I've always agreed with it, that where possible, you must shave every day. Now, if I am in this where it's in the heat of battle, you're not going to stop and have a shave. But any lump, if you've got a cup of tea, you drink half and the other half will be shaving. Because at least it was a bit warm. You weren't particularly, it was a perfect shave. But as long as you weren't starting to go bush, that was the operative thing. That kept morale up. Once you started misshaving and washing, if you were near a river or anything, it was a great help. But under any circumstances, you had to shave as often as possible.
Was there ever any problem with lice?
When you came out, these things, if somebody got them, they seemed to pass along. And when you came out, you got these fellows with the hygiene units with these pumps, powder onto you, lice powder or whatever. The other thing that been embarrassing, what do you call mobile dandruff? Crabs. If you got them, I got them. I nearly died. I thought I've got HIV or whatever you call it these days. And the medical officer said, of course you've got them. Everybody's got them. Some of the lads used to use metal polish, which apparently worked the oracle. But the army had something blue they painted on you, and you stayed there for weeks. It was horrible. So you tried the, they called it Nabby's butter. I don't know where they get that from. Metal polish.
What about the latrines? What sort of latrine provision would you have in the front line?
Depending again on the conditions. Sometimes, I mean, if you're on the move, or you're moving anywhere, any time. A totally different campaign, say Korea, where if you were in a static position, you could be DTLs, proper ones. Common sense prevails. If you have the opportunity to have a latrine, you'll have one reverse over there, out of sight. But invariably, you haven't time for such things, such luxuries.
Was there quite strict latrine discipline in the sense, were you supposed to go in certain places and not in others?
Well, the thing, you took your own trenching tool with you and dug a hole and filled it. Because in hot weather, there's nothing worse than that line of water. The mosquitoes and flies and whatever were being encouraged by it. So you always took the opportunity. Right, you didn't always have the chance to do that. Under certain circumstances.
Just looking at the nature of the fighting, at that time, was there much artillery or mortar fire on the positions? What was it like being under mortar or artillery fire for the first time, and which did you get most at that time?
To kind of the Italian word, I don't want to sound allocated, but to me, we didn't need the shell fire. Whatever else I went, it didn't affect me. You never thought one was going to land on your style of aim, or mine, if it's really heavy, you get under cover as quick as you can. And I mean, if you're below ground, unless you get a direct hit, you're all right. Everybody didn't think the same way. Some were just paralysed with finger when it came over.
Was it shell fire or was it mortars usually you got there?
You got both, but the German mortars, you see, they're a six-barrel mortar. They're all hurdy-gurdy.
The Nebelwerfers?
The Nebelwerfers. They were like a hurdy-gurdy. If you're putting, if you've six mortars in a platoon and you've six barrels to a mortar, you've 66 bombs in the air every few seconds and you can't hear them. Shells, you can. You can hear them whizzing. But mortars just pop out of the blue. But of course, once they start to form a pattern on the ground, you know all the rest are going to follow suit in that area. So you can, more or less, say, have an idea where the next lot's coming. Because they can't change direction so easy with a mortar. And of course, there's bombardment and there's counter bombardment. Once mortars start bombarding you, our mortars will pick up the flash and counter bombard. So it was 6-2-3.
How did our mortars compare with their mortars? It didn't sound
different. Ours is a platoon of mortars in the British Army is six mortars. A good mortar crew can get 50 bombs off a minute. That's just over 1 a second. A good mortar crew. providing you've got that amount, providing you've been able to get your supplies up. And of course, with mortars, you've only really had them as a platoon because they go out on detachments to companies to give support and fire to companies or whatever, wherever they were needed. Based the machine guns as well.
What about cooperation with British artillery? You were usually linked to a unit, actually, but would you be aware of that, that you had forward observation officers up and things like that?
The FOO was always with our IO. The permanent link, the artillery units in the area would all send an officer out to all the units involved. So the eyes of the artillery are with every battalion. And I mean, they have their own code of calling down the chutes, which a lot of officers aren't trained for, infantry officers. So that was all their part. Or he would act on orders from the commanding officer. I want shellfire brought down, a creeping barrage, a box barrage, or whatever barrage he needed. The story there, Peter, would be at that stage of the game in Italy, when all the new weapons were going to the front, D-Day, putting a creeping barrage down, which is self-explanatory, it creeped the infantry in. They were killing more of the infantry than they were of the enemy. And it wasn't lack of efficiency. The barrels were getting worn. There was tolerance in the barrels. If they pulled it short, they killed their own troops. If they gave it a few extra yards, they weren't doing the job of creeping the soldiers in. So it was a catch-22 question at the later stage of the game.
Well, did you think you got the right sort of support from your artillery? I mean, were you happy with the British artillery?
They were never happy with anything that happened. I find that war, there's a great deal of luck involved. You've got information, you've got terrain, you've got climatical conditions, all these things have to be taken. I mean, say climatical conditions. The FOO, the pouring rain, his vision isn't as good. He's got to judge his distance. He's got to judge his line. So although people say the artillery were miles off this morning, there was a lot of factors good with that. But people say the artillery haven't trusted the British. But it wasn't so. There's so many factors have to be taken in.
And did you realise that at the time?
No. These are things you've learned in later years. At that time, you were cursing them. Like friendly fire. This was a regular thing. If you had an inquiry, which they didn't, because nobody did that on purpose. There were communication difficulties, there was you believe it or not, different dialects the old Cockney on called Blimey Boyer, a Geordie on a real Geordie, or a Scotsman or a Welshman, and messages were getting misinterpreted, and consequently, very severe consequences. But nobody really to blame as such.